Well, we are back with another episode of the Disciple Making Leader podcast. I'm your host for today, Ben Borgman, and it's just me and you today, Craig.
Hey, just the two of us, buddy.
We got Pastor Craig, a little decoration. We're celebrating a little St. Patrick's
Day. Top of the morning to you.
Yeah, there you go. Are you Irish, Craig?
You know, actually, I do have some Irish blood in me. Yeah. My mother's maiden name was Ainsley.
Okay.
Which apparently is like Smith over there in Ireland. And so my dad, Etheridge, is English, but Ainsley is Irish. So I've got a little mix. Yeah. I did have red hair when I had hair. Oh, yeah. It was red when I was young.
That explains a lot.
I see. Now you're learning all kinds of new things. And so you know, I have a little proclivity leaning towards St. Patrick's Day. Yeah. It's a little bit of the mother country. I've never been to Ireland, so okay. I'm gonna have to make that happen. At some point.
Keith will have to tell you all the places to go.
That's right. Keith goes all the time.
Yeah.
So he can show me around.
Me as well. So my great grandmother was a McGurnigan.
Oh.
So she was basically full Irish girl, married some German wannabe gangster guy. There's some weird story. Yeah. Anyway, that my grandfather used to tell me. So what we're talking about today is you're passionate about St. Patrick's Day. You have a passion, and not in the green beer, dress right. up, go to a rooftop bar type passion about.
Yes.
You're passionate about the true history of St. Patrick and really who he was, how he developed the movement. And so we're here to really, really reclaim that.
That's right. I'm on a one-man mission to reclaim St. Patrick's Day to be the disciple-making holiday.
And next year, guys, producer Keith, we got to get T-shirts.
That's right.
It's already been requested.
Okay,
we're gonna have disciple making T-shirts next year.
Fantastic, St. Patrick's disciple making T-shirts.
There you go.
And they're gonna go like crazy. I mean, they're gonna be
viral.
Very
viral.
They're going.
That's what the kids say these days.
Going viral.
Probably not.
That's right. No. We can hope.
Yeah,
we can hope.
So with our conversation today, we just really want to kind of unpack, okay, who was St. Patrick? Right. Let's go back to really, because again, history's kind of turned things, you know, kind of has that tendency to just kind of take what was true and then bend it a little bit, and then we add our own celebrations of, you know, dying rivers, and it's all about, you know, what bars and all those things like we said, and, you know, make sure you have, you know, green on and we pinch you, but we kind of lose really who was St. Patrick and he was a very impactful person. Mm-hmm. So let's just go back and want you to kind of walk us through, reclaim that history for us. Yeah. Go back. Who was St. Patrick? Why do you feel so passionate about him as a disciple maker and a movement builder? And just kind of walk us through that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we printed off some notes here. Yeah. Really, a lot of what we're drawing from is George Hunter's the Third's book called The Celtic Wave Evangelism, which I highly recommend this book. It really unpacks a lot of St. Patrick, not just his life, but also the impact that his life had from a disciple-making multiplication standpoint.
Okay.
So I highly recommend the book if people that are listening have not read it.
Yeah.
It's an easy read.
Yeah, we'll make sure we have a link in the show notes for everybody, too.
So it's great. Yeah. But Patricius was actually his Latin name.
Okay.
He grew up in what is ancient Rome, Roman Britain, which is kind of a Romanized part of Great Britain. He was Latin-speaking family. I've heard some that he was in a upper class, but other resources say that he was more of a middle class guy. His parents were believers. His dad was a deacon. His grandfather was a priest. But according to Patrick's own, you know, confession, that he really was a nominal at best. He didn't really think that he was a believer when he was a young man. He kind of rebelled a lot, lived on the wild side a lot, very spiritually, not very concerned about the spiritual things. And so this is kind of the family that he grew up in, pretty much indifferent at that time. But something happened when he was 16 years old that really changed the course of his life, that some Irish pirates.
Oh, wow, this gets a little interesting. Now.
These Irish pirates stormed his area and took a lot of people captive. And they took Patrick at 16 and forced him onto a ship. And they sailed back to Ireland and they forced him into slavery. They literally sold him as a slave to a landowner who was a Druid, mm-hmm. you know, and for 6 years he was in forced labor.
Really?
So he was pulled away from his family. Again, there.
So they weren't taken. It was just him.
Just him. There were other people that were taken.
But not his family.
But he was not taken with any of his family.
Yeah.
And so he was stripped away from them in now this foreign place. They spoke a different language. And he was terrified, of course, as you can imagine. And so for 6 years, he was sold to this landowner. And so he was pretty much committed to just being a shepherd. And he was forced to just watch over sheep or cattle. You know, I've heard two different versions of that. But he was forced to just be out in the elements, right? And so when that happens, when you're stripped, everything is stripped
away. Everything goes away,
You know, all of a sudden praying becomes very important to you. And so while he was out there, Hunter says that he was, he saw the beauty of the land. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the scripture talks about general revelation, you know, that God reveals himself to us by what is seen and what is created. And so he was aware of God's presence being out here kind of in isolation by himself. And then, of course, he was catechized as a young boy. And so he started, you know, he knew some scriptures and knew the God of the Bible, but he just started praying. Wow. And according to Patrick's own testimony, he said he would pray a couple of hundred times a day. I mean, he was just like...
Just a constant.
He had nothing else to do, no one else to talk to, and he was terrified and was afraid. He didn't ever see his family again. Yeah. And so he just started praying. And this was really his first time his heart was opening up to God. Mm. You know, it's interesting, Ben, you know, it's those, when you hit the wall.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Same thing.
We talked about the path of life and hitting the wall, and this was Patrick hitting the wall.
That crisis moment.
Yeah, a crisis moment, and so he's just crying out to God. And somewhere along that way, as he's praying, he came to a profound conversion experience. You know, there wasn't anybody there leading him through the Roman road or anything like that, but he came to really acknowledge his sin, confess that he had been indifferent, that he had been rebellious, that he had not listened to his parents, and cried out for forgiveness and for God to change his heart and his life. And so these 6 years were pivotal years of spiritual formation, really, for him. Apparently, there are some sources that say that there were other Christians in the group of slaves that he would gather with at times. So there probably was some encouragement along that way through them too.
Yeah, it's still interesting to me that he was enslaved, but then as a shepherd. I just feel like that, again, you look all through scripture and how the importance and the lessons people learn, you know, great leaders that were shepherds first, just kind of ties in as you're saying that just, that's where my mind goes of those lessons of taking care of something else that can't take care of itself, what God can reveal through that. It's just an interesting thing that I didn't know.
Think about King David, you know, and all these Psalms that are written when he's in isolation by himself. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a great parallel there to Patrick as a young man shepherding and God getting his attention and turning his heart toward him.
What was the culture in Ireland at that time?
You know, the Brits called them pagans.
Okay.
They called them barbarians, partly because the worship was more Druid type, tribal worship experience. A lot of time they didn't have many of them were not able to read and write.
Okay. Just kind of uncivilized, like kind of a very
much so very tribal.
Okay.
In the early stages, there were just a collection about 150 tribes.
Okay.
And they weren't really unified nation, so to speak. Very tribal, very pagan in a lot of ways. In fact, there are stories about, you know, this whole idea of St. Patrick guiding all the snakes out of Ireland, that really was a caricature of him driving evil spirits out of Ireland with the gospel.
Wow.
That's where we get that whole legend from.
Yeah.
So it's that the preaching of the gospel drove away the darkness. And there are many occasions where he would face off and have these spiritual battles with witch doctors and things like that. I mean, some of them practice, you know, human sacrifices. When they would go to battle, they would strip down completely naked and then they'd charge, you know, and it's like the civilized world saw these people as completely uncivilized.
Gotcha.
So this was the basic culture you know, of the time. Very, very spiritual, but no organized religion. Very mystical, very pagan in so many, many ways. And this is when you look back on how St. Patrick came to take the gospel to Ireland, his 6 years being in prison there really gave him an insight into how these people think, how they live, what matters to them, what are they afraid of, what are they looking forward to, where their hope is. And this is very instrumental. I don't think Patrick could have been as effective if he had just decided as an older man, I'm going to come and evangelize these people, because he didn't really know them. But boy, he learned to know them, you know. And really, Hunter makes a point that he not only came to know them, but he came to have an affinity toward these people.
Yeah, almost like a compassion.
Compassion for them.
Compassion and affinity.
Right.
Like not just an interest, but like a vested interest.
Yeah, I mean, he was forced into their culture. And of course, you know, the first year or so, I'm sure he's just terrified. But then over the course of time, you start to kind of understand how these people operate, right? And so...
So how did he go from slave to being able to be that voice? Like what happened?
Yeah, so it's fascinating. About 6 years into his imprisonment or slavery, really, not really in prison, but slavery, he heard a voice in a dream that said, your ship is ready.
Okay.
And he determined that this was God speaking to him, that he needed to flee.
Wow.
And so he left, he escaped, you know, in the night and traveled 200 miles by foot to the coast, where he found a ship that was headed back to England, and he stowed away on this ship.
Really?
And made his way back.
Okay.
And there's some, I don't know all the details, but there's some idea that that journey wasn't just like from port to port kind of thing, that there were some trouble that he got into, and maybe even a secondary, very brief enslavement before he finally made his way back. But he did board a ship and ended up back home. And you can imagine what his parents thought about, you know, because they don't
showed
know.
Up, yeah.
Yeah, they probably assumed he was dead.
Wow.
And so here he is, you know, he's 16 when he leaves, you know, so now he's in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. But he is not the same Patrick that left, you know, that kind of brash, wild side, indifferent kid is completely changed. You know, he's broken. He has a hunger for God. His whole heart and life has changed. And so really from that point, he feels called to ministry. You know, he does some training. Some sources say he went to Gaul to be trained, which is, I think, modern-day France area. Okay. Others say that he spent some time in Rome, but he was a priest for a period of time and then began to kind of move up in the ranks. And so later in life, you know, he's an established priest and leader in the church in his area in England. But he has another dream.
Okay.
Now, as an older man, and the dream basically was, he dreamed that he received a letter, and this letter was from the people in Ireland, basically saying, would you come here, slave boy, come here and tell us about Jesus.
Really?
And so it was kind of this Macedonian call, right? Wow. That he felt called by God to go back to these people, these people that had enslaved him, these people that he ran from and escaped. And so he went to the powers that be and said, hey, I feel like God's calling me to be a missionary here. And of course they were happy to send him.
Was that normal in the Catholic Church that time? Like in that context? Like missionary, I mean, were they already sending a lot? I mean, was that, or like, hey, I heard from God. I mean, from now, at this standpoint, maybe they've lost that along the way, but at that point, was that pretty, hey, I feel called to missions and they would send? Was that pretty common?
You know, there, of course, early in the Christian movement, you see people taking the gospel rapidly, right? Once, you know, Patrick lived, he was born in 385, so this is probably in the early 400s that he goes. I think that the church had begun to believe that for Christianity to move into what they called pagan or mm-hmm. uncivilized areas, that civilization had to take place first.
Okay.
So they generally felt like, you know, you would hope that a people would become more civilized first, that mm-hmm. they would begin to read and write, and they could understand our cultures and so on, and then we would send priests in there to okay. kind of evangelize these civilized people, yeah. and they move forward. So it was a bit unorthodox for him to go into a completely pagan area mm-hmm. and take the gospel without waiting, you know.
Yeah.
And so later on, you're going to hear that he was criticized for that, mm-hmm. but he felt compelled to do it, and they were like, okay, well, I guess we'll give yeah. it a shot, right? Yeah. And so he was made a bishop before he left, and then he went to Ireland, and it wasn't just by himself. He went with a small team of okay. people. He had a couple other priests with him and a couple other leaders with him. So I haven't seen the exact number, but it was a small band of, okay. of people with him. So he went with a team.
And about how old was he at this point?
You know what? I'm guessing he was in his 50s, but I could be wrong on that. We'll have to look that yeah. up. But I'm guessing he was probably around his 50s. In fact, I think I wrote this down that he died in 461, okay, and he was 385 is when he Yeah. So I'm guessing he was probably in his late 40s, 50s, okay. somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But he was an established guy, and he didn't have to do this. You know, I mean, this was something that God really laid on his heart
yeah.
To do. And so
even then, it was like what you're saying. It was a bit countercultural, or it was a little bit different of a strategy. And that's mm-hmm. kind of as we kind of tie this in here in a minute. It really is. It's not just that. It wasn't just the traditional Catholic strategy to reach new people.
Right.
Like he really was like almost like a current missionary would be now, where you're really learning the context, learning the people, and then going in. It was a bit countercultural, and I think very yeah, again, and we see the fruit. We'll talk about the fruit of that, but that's just an interesting thing I want to point out, that it wasn't just the normal strategy of the day.
No, it was certainly not.
Yeah.
It was certainly not. And so really, this idea of learning the people group and understanding their culture and making the gospel indigenous to that culture, you know, we kind of know that as kind of missiology 101. Yeah. Well, that was brand new. Patrick was really plowing that new ground.
Yeah.
And he becomes a model for the church wow. later on. So anyway, just he returns back there around the 460s, 430s to 460s. So that put him, you know, somewhere in his 50s or so, maybe as late as 60. But he goes there, and he begins to establish churches and share the gospel. Now, what's interesting is his methodology is brilliant, because what he would do is he understood that these tribes, like I said, about 150 tribes, that they all were under the leadership of a tribal leader. Okay. Just be like you go a tribal chief, right? Yeah, that yeah. you're going into a certain area. And so he would go in and meet with the chief and he would appeal to the chief to allow them to camp outside mm-hmm. the area.
Yeah.
And that they came, you know, in peace, and they wanted to befriend them. And I don't know if he would tell them, "Hey, I used to live here." Yeah. I don't know, you know. But he would. He kind of knew how the customs worked,
okay.
and so he appealed to the chief. Then they would establish their camp outside,
mm-hmm.
and then they would do as much as they could to kind of serve that community. You know, if they needed help with farming, or if they needed help with if people were sick, he would pray for their healing.
Yeah.
You know, they established an ongoing conversations with them and just did everything they could to relationally connect and meet basic physical needs
yeah.
of the area. And he said through that, they would establish conversations, mm-hmm. spiritual conversations. And then typically some people would come to faith in Jesus because there wasn't like an established religion and there hadn't been any other religion that had really come into Ireland. Okay. The people didn't have a skepticism like, what are you talking about? Yeah. They were really pretty open. And so they would share the biblical stories. People were drawn to the stories of heroism, you know, in the Bible and God moving in the Bible. So they were very open. These things resonated with their culture. Yeah. And so he would see people come to faith in Jesus. They would baptize them. They would start a church. And when that church got, you know, a pretty good size, then he would leave some of his team there to continue to grow that church and reach the community. They would disciple people within that church. So they were discipling and raising up indigenous leaders, meaning that, you know, they would take those that were, they won, they would build them up, and they would take a few of those new believers with them to the next village. And they'd do the same thing. They'd appeal to the chief, they'd establish outside, they would minister, they'd care for the poor, they would pray for the sick, they would help them any way they can, they would have spiritual conversations, they would win them to Christ, baptize them, disciple them, leave a few, go to the next one. And so this was his general methodology. It was village by village, tribe by tribe, and it was reaching people there, discipling them, and then taking the, engaging them in the mission to reach their own people, which was just fascinating. And so literally following that method, thousands of people came to faith in Jesus. While not every person in Ireland was saved, so many were saved that the whole culture changed. In fact, the slavery that took him to Ireland was first abolished under the Christian influence, right? And so I think that's an interesting point to make here, that the end goal was not social justice. Like, we're going to get rid of slavery. But it was the gospel that Jesus is the only one that can change you. And once your heart is changed, then you see all these
that impact
behaviors that are not in alignment with, you know, the scriptures. And so those things begin to change, you know, in a secondary movement. And so this is what happened with Ireland. And the beautiful thing is that this multiplication took place in such a great way that Ireland became a mission sending center back to Europe. And so when Europe was going into the dark ages and when Europe was, you know, really beginning to fail, it was missionaries from Ireland that preserved the scriptures and preserved the evangelistic zeal and was sent back to Europe. And so really preserved life. And it's just amazing the impact, the incredible impact that Ireland had in perpetuating the gospel. And so you always, even still today, you hear about, well, I'm Irish Catholic, you know, that kind of thing. Well, that all goes back to, you know, to St. Patrick and the tremendous influence he had in that on that island. So his legacy, you know, today, you know, has kind of been diminished to, you know, leprechauns and green beer and pretty much a drinking holiday. But when I think about St. Patrick, I think about a disciple-making leader who, you know, against all odds, you know, did the simple work of going after people, knowing them, loving them, establishing conversations, seeing people come to Christ, discipling them, and engaging them in the mission to multiply. And you see multiplication, you see connection, you see engaging explorers, all the things that we talk about. Patrick was doing this. And it, you know, and of course, where did he get that? Well, he gets that from the scriptures, right? He gets that from Jesus. But it's just so powerful that that methodology worked in Jesus's time in Palestine, right? And now you see it working in Ireland and, you know, several hundred years later, and we still see that same methodology happening today and around the world. And so you just can't improve on Jesus's method. You know, this was Jesus's method, and Patrick really brought the church back to realizing the effectiveness of evangelism and making disciples who multiply. Now, I will say that he was criticized for this by the church. You know, not everyone was giving him a standing ovation because they felt like that when he was sent over there as a bishop, his job was supposed to be to administrate the priest and administrate and kind of care for the people that were already in the church, So if you establish a church, that's great. You need to just take care of those people. And they criticized him because he still wanted to spend time with these pagan people, you know, that didn't know Christ. And he had this just heart to see these people hear the gospel and come to faith in Jesus. And they criticize him for that, which is not unusual either, because Jesus was criticized for the very same thing. Why are you hanging out with these tax collectors and sinners? You know? And so Patrick shared the same criticisms that Jesus did.
That's just, as you're talking, I just keep thinking about this, that my mind goes to, I think people may still be hesitant, or maybe not criticized is maybe not the best word, but there's still friction there when we start as a, like, especially you're in the Bible Belt, and it's like, hey, we're going to, let's start looking outward. Let's not worry so much about just the internal programs that everybody loves and all these things, you know, the kids and all this stuff that, that we've kind of made church to be, but it's, no, the people are out there. How do we get out? How do we engage you and grow you and work outwardly? I think that same tension is still exists today. It's not a, I think we can relate to that just even in our own context now. And I think that's why it's so important to have this conversation is then, you know, like George Hunter kind of gets into these ministry lessons that we can learn. And then, so it's not just this, this historical figure and, you know, this thing, but there's actually lessons to be learned that apply to what we're dealing with and what our listeners are dealing with on a daily basis. And again, I think it's, these are just great reminders. These are good things that really tie history, tie historical movements. I love looking, because, you know, you're kind of big on that historical movement of, and I'm not, again, you're way smarter than I am. You've studied, you've read, you've done all that. But I think it's very interesting the consistencies between those movements.
Yes, absolutely.
And it just continues to drill into me that this is Jesus' way, because, and it's God understands how people work and the best way. He knit us together in our mother's womb.
That's right.
He knows how we relate to people. He knows the best way to move people. And I feel, looking back in history, some people may be, oh, that's kind of boring, but I think it's so practical. And that's why I want to look at, we'll just kind of work through a few of these ministry lessons.
By the way, Ben, in the book, The Disciple Making Leader, I have these little vignettes throughout the book that talk about different movements in different times in history. But they're so different in the context, but they're so the same, right? And I think that's why we're so committed to this Jesus-style disciple-making, because we have seen whenever there were movements of God around the world in various times in history, they were following this very pattern. How they would speak and how they would do it, you know, we're all unique, right? But it was the same basic patterns of engaging explorers, connecting believers, training them up, and multiplying. Those were the exact same in every context.
So true. So for our listeners, we'll have this, basically, we're going to have 10 ministry lessons in the notes for you. We're not going to talk about all those today, but I want them to have that. So we'll kind of make that available to you if you're listening and watching. Just kind of look down there in the show notes, and we'll have all these just to remind you, and you can follow along as you're listening. But let's talk about number one, ministry as a team, not a solo activity. So when we're engaging in ministry, that it's not just me against the world. It should be a team activity. So unpack that a little
bit. Well, you think about how did Jesus do it, right? I mean, Jesus called his first 12, right? I mean, he doesn't have the 12 really until about 2 years into it, but he's gathering his team right from the very beginning. You know, in John 1, he's getting Andrew and John and then Peter and then Philip and then Nathaniel, he's gathering his team. And from there, he's moving as a team. And so I think that Jesus certainly started his ministry as a team, not just a solo act. And Patrick was the same thing. Patrick went over there with a team. But then he was constantly developing new teams that were from the people there. And so I think it's just a good thing to remind you that, you know, some guys go, I'm just going to go out there and knock on doors by myself, or I'm going to go do. Well, that's great. I mean, that's awesome, but better a team with you, right? To have some and be training. But that requires you to think about, how do I train people? How do I gather people around me? How do we go together? I mean, Jesus, even in his ministry, sent them out two by two. You know, at least there was a team of two, you know? And so I think it's just really important to think about, how am I gathering a team of people to accomplish a ministry task? Yeah. And if it's about evangelism, then how can I get a team together that's actually working together? And I think Patrick certainly did a good job, you know, doing this and planting churches. That was, you know, it wasn't just he led them to Christ. He planted churches that would sustain them moving forward. And I think that was another key piece to him.
Yeah. And I think, again, that's taking that lid off of impact. You can have, God can use you mm-hmm. as an individual, sharing your faith, ministering and serving others. But I think it really expands that impact and the possibility. And even like you think about the legacy that he has, would he have had the same legacy if he didn't right. have people around yeah. him and raise them up and send them out?
I'm sure he wouldn't.
And again, for you, like you have, there's going to be people talking about, oh yeah, I remember Pastor Craig. They're not going to be talking about your sermons. They're going to be talking about that you helped them develop personally, spiritually. At one time they were far from God. Now they're walking with God. And then you've got people that you've developed into ministry and worked alongside you, because around here, it's not just, hey, this is about Craig. You're always helping platform other people. You're raising up other leaders to do the work of ministry alongside you. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is where we really get into this expanded impact, this expanded legacy. And again, to me, it's not just, okay, because we can have greater impact. It's know that brings Christ more glory. That reaches more people. That expands the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really great principle that we have to press into, because sometimes that brings a lot of mess in the ministry, because you're dealing with people that maybe not fully developed yet. Yeah. So you have to develop them and walk with them through that. Now you have more people involved in ministry and they all have different opinions. But again, I think it's important to know that you will not have the impact that I think most leaders truly want to have unless they're raising up other people.
You know, and you made a point, Ben, that I think I would just want to underscore, is this is really the antithesis of the celebrity pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you read Patrick's own confessio, you know, his own autobiography, it's very brief. He's very humble. That's one of the things that Hunter points out in his book, just the genuine humility that Patrick goes, who am I? I'm just a shepherd dude, you know, pulled out as a slave. I'm a nobody.
Yeah.
So he wasn't elevating himself as a celebrity, you know. Mm-hmm. He had a very humble view of himself, and he was always pouring into others.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in America, we feel like, hey, if you're really good, then you're a celebrity pastor. You're untouchable by the people.
Yeah.
You've got all the likes and shares on your Instagram or your social media or your X or whatever.
Yeah.
But that was not the mindset of a man who multiplies, and what in Patrick's mindset.
Yeah.
So I just think it's good to note that celebrity pastor mindset was not reflected in Jesus, wasn't reflected in Patrick, and never results in real multiplication.
Yeah, that's so good. The second one we have kind of down here pulled out of George Hunter's book is this idea of belonging before believing. And this really goes back to his initial strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he got boots on the ground, when he went back, it was about, you know, helping people belong before believing. And so unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, in the church that he came from, it was all about belief first, right? And then you get brought into community.
Mm-hmm.
But the way Patrick operated was they would camp outside the village, then they would invite people to come do life with them, and they would go work with them, and they go fish together, and they go spend time together, and they would develop these relational connections with them, and out of that came spiritual conversations that they would eventually lead to faith in Jesus. And that was a real pivot, you know, that instead of saying, no, you have to believe what we believe and then we can befriend you, so we're going to befriend you until you believe like we believe.
Yeah.
And so that was, again, that was a shift in mindset that was unique to Patrick and very counterintuitive to his day.
Yeah.
And I think it can be counterintuitive to us today. I mean, we can draw a very clear line where we're church people. We don't hang out with those who aren't, you know, and until you confess Jesus, then we're not going to hang out with you. But to say, hey, we want to really befriend people that are far from God, that don't believe what we believe. And through that friendship, you know, we kind of earn the right to be heard.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sounds good intellectually, mm-hmm. but it can be dicey, you know, when you're befriending people that are far from God, because, you know, they're saying things or wanting to go places that you want to do. And so, you know, there is a sense of awkwardness about it. But think about Jesus. You know, who did Jesus hang out with, right? He spent time with tax collectors and sinners and people like this that were on the moral fringe of society. And he did so because they were drawn to him. Yeah. And so I think that this is another good lesson for us is how many lost people do I know that would call me their friend?
Yeah.
And go, yeah, he's a pastor, but I really like Craig, you know. What does that look like? I think that's just a challenge for us from Patrick.
And I think it's a reminder too, because this is kind of woven in, especially when we're training people, when we're kind of discipling guys personally. How to help them navigate that, especially when we get into Reach Your World, the second book of the Grow series, it really goes back to, hey, you can, to me, the lesson I learned here is it goes back to he loved them, he had a compassion, he saw them, just like Jesus. Mm-hmm. He saw the people and he had compassion on them. Mm-hmm. So how do we help people? You're not trying to work somebody over. You're not trying to, manipulate them. You're a friend with them just to be a friend with them.
Yeah.
You're their friend because they're in your life and because God loves them. And so you have compassion on them. And so, but out of that, what's the purpose? Where's the direction of that? And so I think that's where it's helpful to remind people of why are you even, you know, that, you know, it's not a, okay, I'm a friend with them so that. It's not that. It's a friend because they need love, they need service, they need to do that. But out of that, God can use that to turn their hearts and cultivate a more positive heart to the gospel. And I think that's really how, you know, helping people do that. And again, it's not a transaction. It's okay to make this a long run sometimes.
Yeah.
The Spirit of God sometimes may take a little while to work some things out in people. So it's not always just an instantaneous thing. But that investment in a relationship before they come to Christ is very important.
Yeah, and honestly, Ben, a lot of times we have all of our bandwidth for friendships taken up with Christian friends.
Yeah.
You know, so there's not a lot of room
in
our life for people that are not Christians.
For sure. Yeah.
And I think that's something that's a good reflection, you know, am I creating relational space in my life?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, you know, you kind of go on. I'm going to go through. We're kind of getting towards the end of our time, but he talks about radical hospitality. I think that's really, that kind of goes into that idea of, you know, hospitality is very attractive to people. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about these two together, two more of these before we wrap.
Yeah.
This contextualization and respect for culture and leadership development and indigenization. See, I said it.
You did.
Indigenization. I'm from Arkansas, but I can. I'm good.
You I've did been great, in Texas man. Long. You did so good.
So, but I think this is really important from a especially from a church planting or if you have an international work. If we're talking to leaders that are listening, that you have an international work, especially, I think this is a high priority that you don't just go in and say, hey, it's all about us. But how are you raising up indigenous leaders? How do you contextualize? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, newsflash, you know, we're in America. Like, for instance, we're going to Nepal here in a month. Mm-hmm. The same teaching, the same methodology, the same delivery does not work. It has to be contextualized. The principles translate because they're Jesus principles.
That's right.
The movement principles translate, but the contextualization is very important. And how are we raising up indigenous leaders and training and equipping them and pouring into them so that they can go into places we would never be able to go?
Yeah. Contextualization is really about how do I communicate these things in the way that that fit with their culture, you know? And Patrick did a good job of this. You know, Patrick, because he was immersed as a slave there for a period of time, he kind of understood and kind of took on some of their cultural norms, values, how they did things, and was able to translate that, the gospel, into that. Yeah. Now, and he wasn't trying to make them Brits.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't trying to make them European necessarily. Yeah. He was trying to say, okay, how do I take the principle of the gospel and put it in their language and their culture? Yeah. And so I think this is really important. Like you said, when you're working cross-culturally, this is super important. But even asking yourself the question, am I taking the gospel and making it fit the culture of Texas or, you know, wherever, where Colorado or wherever I'm at, am I able to translate the gospel in a way that these people could understand? And, you know, that's where we get the shamrock, you know, because he would take a shamrock and which was indigenous there and then try to explain the Trinity through that. You know, he was just trying to find ways that, okay, this is like what he's saying. And think about how Jesus did. How many times when Jesus is teaching in parables and he's giving concepts of the kingdom of God, it's like a sower that goes out to sow. Why is he talking about that? Because that's what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're not talking about bending the gospel to the culture. We're talking about being relatable with the gospel, finding relatable ways to communicate the gospel, to love people, to explain principles and truth.
Right.
Again, because some people take that pendulum and swing it all the way over. Well, now we're going to bend the gospel to culture.
Right. And, you know, like, David wrote, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, because he was a shepherd, you know. Maybe if he was born in Texas, he'd say, the Lord is my ranch hand, you know. I don't know. But the point is, you're taking the gospel and communicating it in that culture that they can understand. Today, you know, we can talk in Christianese and we can talk in a lot of terms that the average guy can't fully understand. Yeah. So I take this even down to preaching. When I'm preaching, I can take the biblical terms and concepts. We can talk about justification, sanctification, all that kind of thing. We can talk about that. But how do I communicate that in a way that a person that just showed up that day could understand it?
Yeah.
And Jesus was a master at that. And Patrick was really good at that. And so I think you have to say, how can I communicate these biblical truths in a way, culture, that they can grasp and understand? And then the indigenization simply just means that when he would go into these villages, he would disciple these people and then engage them in the movement. Yeah. So the movement really began to be perpetuated by Irishmen.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is the way it should be.
Which is the way it should be. And he weren't, again, they weren't trying to make them English. And so how is your church taking people that you're leading to Christ and discipling them so that they're a part of the movement?
Yeah.
And it's not just the preachers doing that or the people who went to seminary doing that, but the average person that's in your church feels empowered to make a difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the greatest joys I have in ministry is I look at guys on our leadership council and I look at guys that are leading out in ministry areas, and I knew when they weren't believers.
Yeah.
And then they came to faith and they got discipled and they got a heart for God. And now they're starting to disciple other people.
Yeah.
And then God's just giving them greater opportunities to lead.
Yeah.
And I just take great joy in that, you know, you don't have to have a ministry degree, you know, to do this. Where Jesus didn't choose people out of the seminaries in Jerusalem for this. He chose common, ordinary men that were hot-hearted for God, that had been discipled and trained, and were ready to advance the kingdom. And that's how it's always been. And Patrick does a good job of doing that.
And I think I think that's a great application, because again, I talked about Nepal, talked about overseas, but I think, as you're talking, I'm like, what a great application of that same principle to a coach. Like you've had God's open doors for you with coaches through schools, but those coaches, even though you've had impact through high school and through being a chaplain period of time, things like that, your investment in you training up coaches, they can reach people that you would never be able to reach.
Oh, for sure.
From students to other coaches to, I mean, so the same thing, that movement continues through indigenization. It's not just another culture necessarily, but it's a place that that people wouldn't be able to relate to you as well as they would be able to relate to that coach or that, you know, or business guys, right? There's just something so powerful about that applies to everybody.
Yeah, I have a coach that is a friend of mine. 10 years ago, he came to faith in Jesus. I discipled him. I still work out with him.
Yeah.
But he, when they're on the practice field, he gets quarterbacks together. He's sharing a verse every week.
Yeah.
And then he said, "Hey, I need some books." I said, "What are you doing?" "Well, I got in my break, on my off period, you know, I'm discipling some football players." And you know, I'm thinking, you know, he is taking the gospel very, like you said, in an indigenous way, right into that culture and reaching people that would never come to our church on Sunday. And so I'm just super proud of him. And God delights in that, right? He delights in using common people.
Yeah.
And so we learned this from Patrick. We should be putting that to work in our own life, in our own ministry.
Yeah. Well, you heard it first right here, disciple-making leader, St. Patrick. Hopefully you've reclaimed this, or at least started the momentum towards towards reclaiming St. Patrick's Day as a disciple-making holiday.
And, yes.
So I do thank you for kind of opening our eyes to that, but unpacking some of that. Again, as you're watching and listening back at home, I just want you to know that we have a lot of resources for you in the show notes. So from the books that Craig, from George Hunter that Craig referenced, and that list of the 10 mission, kind of the ministry lessons, you're going to see those in the show notes. So just, again, thank you for watching. Thanks for listening. Disciple First really just exists to encourage and equip you as disciple-making leaders, and this show is a part of that. So we hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you next time.